my pleasure to introduce Dr. Laura Frederick Merrick with the USDA ARS at Iowa State University.
Thank you, Rich. And actually, I work for Iowa State University at a USDA location.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Today I'm going to talk to you about sunflower crop, cultivated crop, and wild species germplasm from the Southwest. It's in the National Plant Germplasm System, and I will present a couple examples about how both have provided value for crop improvement. And also, I want to talk a little bit about a couple of the species which have provided a really nice example for evolutionary ecologists to illustrate one of their theories about speciation. But first, just a little context for the collection. So the United States has had a formal system for acquiring, conserving, evaluating, characterizing, documenting, and distributing crop germplasm for a number of decades, and this system had its informal beginning really at the beginning of our nation. We are a nation of farmers, and even like the early politicians, many of them were farmers. Germplasm and seeds were greatly valued, really important. You didn't survive if you didn't have good seeds. And so you can see on the map here that currently the National Plant Germplasm System is 20 plus locations. There are 20 locations on the map, and you can see covering a wide range of latitudes and also temperature zones. And so the sunflower collection is in Ames, Iowa. Let's see if I can actually do this, maybe. Here in central Iowa. We're on a little over 100 acres of Iowa State University Agriculture Experiment Station land, a joint project between the ag experiment stations of the 12 north central states, Iowa State University, and the USDA ARS. So here, standing in our main distribution cold room, 4 degrees, 20 to 30% relative humidity. And the working groups at the North Central Regional Plan Introduction Station, we have seven working and utilization teams, and then five curation projects. I curate the oilseed project, which includes the sunflower collections. So sunflower is a native North American crop. It's fairly unique among crops to be in that situation. And the USDA collection for management purposes, I have it divided into cultivated and wild species. So the cultivated collection has been in Ames since the station opened in 1948 and contains a variety of germplasm types, so landrace material and other open pollinated populations, inbred lines, pre-breeding lines, there's an association mapping population, about 2,500 accessions total. The wild collection also has about 2,500 accessions. And it's been in Ames since 1985 when it was transferred there from Bushland, Texas, where it was started in the 1970s. And Dr. Seiler was the original curator and helped get the collection really started. And it is the most comprehensive collection of wild sunflower species in the world, and well, it should be. It's native to North America. All but one of the extant 63 taxa have populations in the United States. We really have a responsibility to have a good genetic and geographic representation of all these taxa in our collection. And we're actually still doing active collection to fill in geographic gaps. And so for me to talk about the germplasm from the Southwest, I have to decide, well, what is the Southwest? You know, if you Google Southwest, you could, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities there. So I just decided to go with the north latitude being 39 to 40 degrees, and then the east boundary being the east edge of the Llano Estacado, so that's about 101 longitude, and then going west to about 116, and then far enough south so you catch the boot of West Texas. And then arbitrarily, I've also included that little square of land that's over there just east of Reno, where there are populations of Helianthus deserticola, which the only other populations of deserticola are there along the southern Utah and northern Arizona border. It's a southwestern species, so I'm including that as just a little corner extra of the Southwest. And so in the NPGS collection, we have 758 accessions that I could consider southwestern. First, the cultivated germplasm. There are 22 landrace accessions from the southwest. And then we also have about 132 accessions where both inbred lines that the folks in Fargo have developed over the years and also some new material pre-breeding lines, so that's not as well developed, it hasn't been backcrossed as much, that's got germplasm introgressed in from the from wild southwestern species. And so, of course, the largest collection, individual species from the southwest are the wild Helianthus annuus, almost 300. And then of the remaining 16 taxa, 9 of them are endemic, so their populations are only in the southwest, and includes one taxa that is on United States Fish and Wildlife Threatened and Endangered Species list, Helianthus anomalous. So just a quick look at how these populations are distributed that we have samples from. So my quick and dirty use of Google Maps didn't allow me to put everything on one map, and that would have been way too many colors, and you can hardly see the colors that there are there anyway. So first showing the annual species, and of course, Helianthus annuus in the navy blue here is predominant, but also it's true that from the annual species we do have a good coverage across the whole southwestern region. And then you want to then look at the perennial species. So not so much the case, even though so there were 9 annual species, there's 8 perennials. There are 3 species that are endemic, so the Ciliaris group, so Ciliaris, Laciniatus, and Arizonensis, so down here in Texas, New Mexico, and then the Arizonensis here, Arizona, which are actually, that's really good representation from the current known populations. But for the other perennial species, except for Pumilus, which are the gray dots up here in Colorado, they represent populations that are really on the margin or the edges of those species ranges. And so we're actually, though, really interested in populations that do come from the margins, because they have to adapt to perhaps some environmental conditions that the other populations aren't normally exposed to. So you may have some more interesting genetic variation. So for example, when we were in New Mexico in 2012, and we collected 3 Nataliae species. It was just sort of fascinating to me. So there's one up here by it's north of Las Vegas, and I forget, Wagon Mound. And then down here over by Cloudvale, Cloudcroft, there you go. and the third one, I'm not going to remember where it is on here. You can't tell the colors. There's also supposedly one more population over down in here that we haven't had time to look for. But most of the Nataliae is much farther north and then to the east, more in central U.S. So the perennials are actually pretty interesting. And then just a quick look then at the distribution of the endemic species, the 9 endemic species across the southwest there. So there's evidence of sunflowers being used in the southwest since prehistoric times. So there are carbon dating samples from archaeological sites from at least 4,000 years before present. I couldn't find any pictures of those. So these artifacts are from just a couple hundred years prior to when the first Europeans got into the area, so early 1300s. These from a cave that are northwest of Kayenta in northeast Arizona in the Navajo Nation, so sort of right behind that ridge where the arrow is. And then here's just an extant, current wild annuus population that's then northeast of Kayenta on the north side of Comb Ridge. So all the archaeological evidence, though, from the southwest is wild species. There are not domesticated canes or samples from the early times in the So in fact, sunflower was domesticated in the eastern United States. And so in the archaeological evidence provided by Bruce Smith in his recent paper, which these two, the image and the figure, are from, I'm really sorry that I'm just incompetent for moving this little arrow around here with the computer, but so the actual oldest direct dated sample is from that Hayes site in central Tennessee, but apparently those samples have been misplaced. And so the image is from a cane from the Newt Cache site up there in Kentucky. So domesticated 4,000 to 5,000 years before present, which is about half the time that corn's been domesticated. So corn was domesticated about 9,000 years before present. And then there is good supporting genomic evidence for this out of Warren Reisberg's lab. Ben Blackman and other folks there have done to support the concept that there's been one domestication and it took place in the eastern United States. So when the European settlers arrived, they found the Native Americans growing cultivated sunflower. So here, this is an engraving based on a painting by Thomas White, 1585, of a village in North Carolina, and there were the cultivated sunflowers. There's also maize growing there, so apparently they would plant at different times. So there's three plantings of maize, but then clearly maize is a plant introduction. It is not native to North America. So there were trade routes that brought the maize to the eastern United States, and those same trade routes then carried the cultivated sunflower back to the southwest. And so the image on the on your right, then one of Gary Nathan's photographs from Landrace growing there in near the Hobie, Black Mesa near Tuba City in Arizona. And so what I think is interesting is that, okay, so when the Europeans arrived, the Native Americans were growing sunflowers and corn and squash and beans, but then the Europeans did not pick up on sunflower to cultivate it. You know, they were growing corn and the squash and the beans, but it took taking sunflower back to Europe to develop it into our modern crop. And so the first documented records of sunflower in Europe are from the early 1500s, Spanish explorers. So actually those southwestern land races were the first to go back to Europe, to Spain, in the early 1500s. Although for sure, because the sunflowers were also in the eastern United States, there were many times that sunflowers were taken back. People were very interested in germplasm. There were gardens, the nobility and the wealthy people had botanic gardens and sunflower. If you can imagine, I mean, we've all seen sunflower routinely, but you come over from Europe, you've never seen a sunflower before. You've got one of those tall plants, big head, yellow ray flowers. They're just gorgeous. They went, you know, took them back to Europe and put them in their gardens. And then they moved east across into Russia by the late 1600s. And so the story about Russia developing it into an oil crop, so by 1779, for sure, it was an oil crop in Russia because there's a publication in their scientific proceedings about a method for producing oil from the sunflower seeds. But so the Orthodox Church had strong control over what you could eat during Lent. Many things were forbidden. Oils from animal fats and olive oil was forbidden, but they didn't know about sunflower. Sunflower was not forbidden. At the time, folks were using hemp oil as a replacement for butter and lard during Lent. But as they started to use sunflower seeds more, that oil was better quality than hemp. And after they'd done some breeding, it really tasted better. So that's where, in Russia, was where sunflower really became an oil seed crop. And they did intensive breeding. And so, including using crop wild relatives, so tuberosis, Helianthus tuberosis, had made its way to Europe too because you could eat the tubers. And that was the first wild species that they used in Russia for crossing into cultivated sunflower. So there was disease resistance and other traits that they found useful. And that's like hard. I mean, they're crossing perennial with the wild species. That's tough. But they were very, it was successful. And then they continued, the Russian breeders continued to use wild species over time. And the crop, as a crop, returned to the United States, first to Canada with immigrant Mennonite farmers, late 1800s. And breeding in Canada was, by the mid-1930s, stimulated by, you know, war shortages of oil there, the world wars. And not really any intensive breeding in the United States until sunflower started to be developed as a hybrid seed crop. And so I've already mentioned that the cultivated sunflower collection in the NPGS was started in 1948. That was decades before there was a real public breeding effort in sunflower. And so all of the early material that was in the collection was from other countries, international, where the breeding to develop into a crop took place. So sunflower is a Native American crop. It was domesticated in North America, but the development as a modern crop took place elsewhere. And so, okay, I probably can't navigate the arrow to United States, but you could maybe see that where it is on the chart. The countries are alphabetical. So our first accession that was derived, United States derived, came into the collection in 1964. Most of the material, though, was received after 1980. From the United States, about 6% between 64 and 1980, but that 6% included our land race materials. So the first land race accessions we received in 1968, there were four accessions from Charlie Heiser. Two of those were Southwestern material. And then in 1978, Gary Nabhan was supported, put in a request to collect because he had recognized that this land race material was disappearing in the Southwestern cultures, and he made the collections and donated 19 to the NPGS collection in 1978. So I've already mentioned that sunflower has been very successful incorporating useful traits from crop wild relatives, so there's a long history there. There are no GMOs in sunflower. So trait improvement comes largely from breeding within what's available and then crossing in useful traits from crop wild relatives. And so, of course, transfer is a complex, long process. And so this, Dr. Bamberg already touched on this. They actually do some of the breeding themselves in Sturgeon Bay to take the wild germplasm and put it into the cultivated material so that you can start the domestication process. So for sunflower, the group in Fargo, North Dakota, USDA group has done quite a bit of this over time. Dr. Seiler has done a lot of crossing with wild species. And so we have material in the collection, about 500 of the lines total, that have various integrations from various of the species. And 405 of those have been recently genomically characterized by Dr. Riesberg's lab at the University of British Columbia. So we know on which linkage groups and exactly where on the linkage groups the integrations occur. And 132 of those lines have Southwestern donor species. A lot of the new material, the new integrations that have come with the Canadian material, we've only gotten that earlier this year, and so the evaluations as to what useful traits they have are still in the very early stages. And valuable traits that sunflower does have, in the cultivated sunflower has from wilds, the most valuable then is the cytoplasmic male sterility, which has allowed for establishment of sunflower as a hybrid seed crop. And then herbicide tolerance is another really important, becoming more valuable over time, that was crossed in from wild species. And then various disease resistance genes and other material. And so we have useful material that's been useful for crop traits into the crop. And then in addition, some of the wild species from the Southwest have been used to support the concept of homoploid hybrid speciation. So you have Helianthus annuus and Helianthus petiolaris, both of which grow in So I have different habitats, so the annuals prefer a little bit wetter conditions than the pediolaris, and they will hybridize. The offspring are generally very not fertile, less than 1%, but the Southwest contains a lot of very extreme habitats. And so if you have any of the offspring survive, and they can survive in any of these extreme habitats, then the separation of habitat allows for the new species to be developed. And so Helianthus paradoxus there on your right, which is adapted to growing in brackish, salty marshes. They've done genomic analysis, and the chloroplast haplotype is Helianthus annuus, and indicates a single origin of that species. For Helianthus anomalous, the different populations, some of them have pediolaris chloroplast haplotype, some of them have annuus, so there have been multiple speciation events to create anomalous. And then desert tickle, it's ambiguous. They haven't figured that one out yet, but they're doing sequencing, and so maybe it will be determined. So we have this great germplasm. And so this just shows where those five species exist in the Southwest, and we have a really nice distribution. We've done collecting now twice in that region for those, and pretty much have all the populations well sampled. So we have the great germplasm. The other mission, one of the missions of the NPGS is that we distribute germplasm and make it available for scientific and educational purposes. Domestic distributions are usually pretty straightforward. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does put some restrictions on use of species that are on their threatened and endangered species list, so that means Helianthus paradoxus. And then for international shipments, we have the Treasury imposes sanctions on trades with some countries, but mostly for international shipments, the countries have like disease additional declarations or whatever that they have to deal with. And then we have a database, Grain Global, so you can order the germplasm. The first step in ordering it is to go online and create a user profile, and then you can set up, it's basically a shopping cart ordering system. So just to quickly summarize, Southwestern stunflower germplasm is maintained by the Plant Introduction Station in Ames, Iowa, part of the NPGS. We have 604 accessions of wild southwestern species, 22 accessions of cultivated land races, and 132 accessions of cultivated breeding lines with introgressions from southwestern species. And sunflowers have been in use in the Southwest since prehistoric times, and five southwestern species provide a well-characterized example of homoploid hybrid speciation, and our germplasm is available for distribution. And then, so I don't operate in a vacuum at the station there in Ames. We have a pretty good team. We work really well together. But I don't have a picture of any of the students up there. We have 40 to 50 students working with us to do like the really hard physical labor, because like I'm too old to do that kind of thing. I see Vivian back there, who was one of our student workers, one of the best workers I ever had on my crew. So thanks.
Thank you very much.